I wanted to welcome you to the session on the update of the Hispanic Community Health Study, a study of Latinos, Seoul, and it's sponsored by the APHA Latino Caucus. My name is Carlos Somera. I'm a behavioral scientist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we have three fabulous panelists that will be giving you the update on a large-scale epidemiology project that aims to look at risk factors and prevalence of diseases and the role of acculturation on the health of Latinos. We have Dr. Talavera, we have Dr. Giacello, and Dr. LaHouse.
Buenas tardes. Well, first of all, we're very excited about the fact that we are here providing some preliminary finding of this historical study that we call SOL. And we are a panelist here that's going to be giving you first the overview of the SOL, a little bit of background and rationale, and then some selected findings that have not yet published. We expect that our publication will come out, this coming spring. We're working on that. And then we would end up with some implication in terms of public health strategies and how can we be able to encourage and identify more junior investigators to really take advantage of this data for their own dissertation or for manuscript development. So with that, let me get started. The three panelists already have been introduced. My name is Aida Giacello. And most of you may know me in association with the University of Illinois Midwest Latino Health Research Training and Policy Center. Since March, I started at Northwestern University, Department of Preventive Medicine, Femdor School of Medicine. And I'm one of the co-principal investigators for the Chicago Field Center. And let me begin. It's mandatory to say that we have no conflict of interest. So there is no personal financial relationship with any commercial interest relevant to the presentation for the past 12 months and forever in my case. But anyway, as I mentioned, briefly, we are the objective. I mentioned it very briefly, so I'm going to move on. Now, my responsibility in this panel is to really give you an overview of the background, rationale, objective, and design. What is the background? Well, we know, and all of you who are here and who are involved in research on Latino health, you know that there's still very limited research data on a number of conditions, despite the fact that in the last decade we have done tremendous amount of improvement in getting data, and that the Latino Caucus actually has been instrumental in terms of its leadership to advocate and engage in policy to make sure that there's more research and data. And Ruth Zambrana from the audience has been one of those pioneers for the longest time with the Latino Caucus, as well as many others, in trying to really create the awareness and to advocate very, very strongly regarding this issue. The other reason is that the Latino population is growing very rapidly. All of you have seen the year 2010 census, which really show an accelerated growth of the Latino population despite the many challenges in immigration. It still continues to grow very rapidly. And then we know that when we talk about Hispanic, we're talking about people that come from more than 20, 23 countries. There's tremendous amount of diversity by national origin, by language, by socioeconomic status, by level of acculturation and assimilation. And despite that, most of the studies that has been conducted so far has been primarily focusing on the Mexican or Mexican population in the southwestern region, or the Puerto Ricans in the new northeast area, and the Cuban in the southeast. And that in reality, the gap of data about those that come from Central South America or any other part of the Caribbean is practically of non-existent. So the one of the uniquenesses of the study is the fact that for the first time, we're going to get data on cardiovascular and related condition for Central South America, and even on a specific population of those region. And we also were surprised to find that the Dominicans are not only in the New York City, but they're in Chicago and other places. So we separated the Dominicans in our data because of the high number of them that were participant in our study. Other reasons is the poor access to health services. We've been advocating for the longest time. We know that Latinos have the highest percentage of people without health insurance in this country. Depending on the data that you look at, it could be 35%. Or it could be as high as 60% of studies that I have done about migrant workers in Illinois. So not only they don't have health insurance, but they're not linked to a regular source of medical care. They experience linguistic, cultural barriers in obtaining access to health services. And for that reason, overall, most of the Latino underutilize the health and mental health services in the United States. The Hispanic paradox, we all, you know, those of you that are working on Latino issues, you know that the Hispanic paradox still prevails, that there's differences in outcome among immigrant versus non-Latino immigrant or U.S. born by a diverse of areas. And so that's still one of the areas that we have decided to zero in and make sure to see to what degree this study will be able to give us additional light into some of the issues and arguments that constantly takes place about whether or not being immigrant is a benefit or where, at what point, once they come to the United States, the health is deteriorating rapidly and affecting the number of outcome, in our case, cardiovascular and related conditions. And now most data is also indicating that there is an increasing prevalence of risk factors for cardiovascular disease and other chronic diseases among Latinos. So we want to know more about that and some of what are those risk factors and to what degree they're impacting cardiovascular. So this is particularly a study on longitudinal methodology because there has been very few studies really looking at Latino for a longer period of time. So the first period is about seven years. We just got word that there's going to be a competitive renewal coming out in November, and we believe that may take us to 5 or 7 more years into the study. And we hope this will be in itself an historical study in the sense that we may be able to continue receiving funding to assess the health of the Latino population across a number of many years, and that would really help us tremendously in better understanding their health needs and health status. And then for this particular presentation, we wanted to highlight the fact that another reason for conducting this study and proposing this panel is to be able to address the underrepresentation of Hispanic Latino research. It's a very, very serious problem. The fact that we don't have enough Latino being trained as researchers, and that as a result, most of the research on Latino has been done by non-Latino population. It will continue to be that, and that's fine. And one of the things that we also advocate is to make sure that those non-Latino develop the cultural competency to be able to do good research on the Latino population as we try to build a pipeline. And so one of the many messages at the end of this presentation is how can we work together to make sure that the Latino investigators that are there be able to participate in many of the ancillary studies that are constantly being developed and funded, and how they could utilize the data that is going to be made available next year for the population in general of research and academia, including the junior or those that are interested in becoming or moving into Latino research status. And related to that is the need for training opportunity of Hispanic Latino health among professionals. So this study is a collaboration across diverse institutes and center. The main funder is the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, but then there's about 6 other institutes and centers which are listed here, and you have it in the fact sheet that I gave a few minutes ago. There's some extra fact sheet and brochure here in the front of the panel desk if you have not received yours. But it's not only the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, because diabetes is an area, as you know, very closely related to cardiovascular, for which we have gathered tremendous amount of data, but also neurological disorder and stroke, deafness and other communication disorder, dental and craniofacial research, the Institute for Minority Health and Health Disparity, also a strong collaborator, and the Office of Dietary Supplement. So this is really historical in itself because of the tremendous amount of interest and collaboration across institutes at the National Institute of Health. Now, what are the goals? The goals, and many of them were stated in the brochure that was distributed. And again, for those of you who are coming now, there's brochure and fact sheet here in the front that you could take it after the presentation. Is number one is to identify the prevalence of cardiovascular, pulmonary disease, and related conditions in the United States Hispanic Latino group of diverse background. And then the second goal is to identify the prevalence of factors that protect from or increase the risk for cardiovascular and pulmonary disease and other conditions in diverse U.S. Hispanic Latino groups. And thirdly, is to identify all causes of mortality and the incidence of fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular and pulmonary events in diverse Latino population. And here you, to the right, you see one of the posters that we developed, and they was used heavily to promote the recruitment of Latino across the different sites that I will be describing shortly. So the methodology is a multi-center community-based cohort study. It targets Hispanic Latino adults in certain areas in Bronx, Chicago, Miami, and San Diego. The total sample was 16,000 Latino between the ages of 18 and 74. 4,000 per field center needed to be identified based on a very rigid sampling design. And only those people that were able to identify themselves as Hispanic and Latino were included in the sample. So you had a lot of Latinos who don't identify themselves as such, so they were not included. Or people who were non-Latino but said that they were Latino, so we had to include them even if we had some doubts. But anyway, you always happen. So of those, about 63%, 10,000, are between the ages of 45 to 74. An effort was made in the sampling design to assure that we have an over representation of Latino, I guess I'm competing with something. Well, bear with us, technology, you know. But anyway, we really want to make sure that we have older adults between the ages of 45, 74. So there was an oversampling technique of identifying household they had individual within those age group. And we also made sure that there was sufficient sample size for other subgroups of Latinos so we could be able to engage in comparison for that. In this case, Cuban versus Central and South American, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Dominicans. And Brenda Lee, who used to be in the field center of the Miami, she just joined us. So hello, thank you for coming as well as everybody else. The diverse participant, really, an effort was made to get representation from people that live in the target selected community or cities participating in the study. And so we really made an effort to make sure that there was representation by socioeconomic status. We also want to make sure, again, that there was sufficient representation in the selected areas of people with diverse nationality. So there were a lot of careful thoughts and detailed planning that went, hi Olivia, that went also into the process to make sure that we really get that representative sample that we are desperately in need to get. And here are, this map reflects the different communities or cities that where we have a field center located. So Chicago with Northwestern University, Bronx with Albert Einstein Medical School, School of Medicine, the Coordinating Center at the North Carolina Chapel Hill, the Miami Center in San Diego, for which we have today Dr. Talavera as the PI of that center, as well as Sheila Castanel working also in that particular center. The Chicago Field Center, the target, target sampling for us was to make sure that we get 50% of the Mexican and 30% of Puerto Rican, and also 15% of Central and South America. And we actually were able to meet the goal. Some of the challenges, as we will discuss, is more with recruitment, tremendous amount of surprises, a lot of challenges in trying to get those 4,000 because of the immigration fears, because of gentrification, or a number of factors that occurred in some of those sites. And so in the beginning, when I was involved, I was representing the Midwest Latino Health Research Training and Policy Center. And like I said earlier, I just moved to Northwestern Department of Preventive Medicine. In Miami, the target goal was to be able to get over 55% Cuban and about 35% Central and South America. Another challenge, we could not find the Cubans in the selected area. And so and those of you and Brenda Lee, who was trying to deal with that and advise how to move, the sampling site or the sample, the selection of a community had to be changed to be able to find out where are actually the Cuban. And by surprise, we got a tremendous amount of people from Central and South America in the original selected areas in the Miami, the city of Miami. And then obviously the Miller School of Medicine was the entity that represented the Miami Field Center there at the University of Miami. New York, again, the Bronx Field Center, they targeted as a goal 55% Puerto Rican and approximately 25% Dominican. It turned out that they heavily were able to find more of the Dominicans sooner, although they did meet the goal for the Puerto Rican. And Albert Einstein, as I mentioned before, is the entity there that is representing the Bronx Field Center. San Diego, again, the target goal was more 90% and to get not only Mexican, but Mexican-American. And there was a consortium there of the San Diego State University together with the University of California at San Diego and the San Isidro Health Center who provided the clinic where most of the health screening took place. And again, Dr. Talavera, Dr. Jones, and Michael Krithik were the key investigators there. And then the coordinating center at Chapel Hill, they just changed their PI. Now we have Gian Nguyen Kay, I'm not sure if I pronounced that well, with Geraldo Hayes are now the PI. Larissa Lavench just moved out of that position to accept a role at the Federal the Food and Drug Administration just in the last month or so. And so their role was critical because not only they had to build the infrastructure for the entire field center, but they were responsible for the study design. Everything that has to do with sampling was under their control. They had to develop the protocol, the data collection forms, the manuals of operation. They provided project management and logistics support. They coordinated all the activity across the diverse field centers. They provided the statistic expertise. They establish and maintain quality assurance program, perform analysis of the study data to prepare abstract for scientific meetings and manuscript, and they conduct constantly training about statistical analysis accommodating the sampling plan. So a tremendous amount of responsibility fell in the coordinating center, and from my perspective, they did an excellent job in keeping us on target and making sure and being heavily involved with every single center, and which had different challenges at different point in time, and making sure that we were making the progress that were needed in a given point in time. Then on top of all that, we have what we call the reading centers and the central laboratory. And here you have the list of all the many entities that were involved for the diversity of reading centers and laboratory. So we have the central laboratory, we have electrocardiogramma, a reading center, the sleep reading center, the pulmonary function test reading center, the nutrition reading center, the cognitive center, the audiometry reading centers, and the list goes on and on with all the many collaboration and wonderful work of experts in those fields. And then you have the office, the project office at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. You have the laundry list of people who have been providing leadership, oversight, really making sure that the budget and everything else is being properly used, that we any decision that has to do with the implementation of the study had to be approved by them. And we have the OSMB committee that met with us once a year. I believe that one of the members is here as well. I can't remember her name. But anyway, they were doing excellent work in helping us along the line in giving us the technical advice and expertise to make sure that we're doing everything in conformity with rules and regulation and policy. So the data collection overview, well, basically it was a baseline medical history and exam procedure. They were given to all the participants of the study to identify risk factor. Then there was a series of cross-sectional analysis, inclusion of all Hispanic Latino group and comparison of risk and disease among subgroup, and then the longitudinal analysis, which is the stage that we are right now doing follow-up and retention so we could be able to identify those kinds of events and death that needs to be documented and that needs to be called for. And again, the inclusion were people 18 to 74 to investigate the risk and disease across the age spectrum. Here you have a list of all the many examinations that took place in average between 7.5 hours. We kept every participant who agreed to participate and who actually met the criteria of the study. So not only we obtain information about the personal background, but also medical history for themselves and the family, lifestyle habit, nutrition, socioeconomic status, information about acculturation and psychosocial factor, vital signs, anthropometry, electrocardiogram. Forgive my accent. When you're trying to go fast, you mix your English and your Spanish, and then in chapel that's some of the words is that things that we could pronounce well anyway. And oral glucose tolerance, ear exam and audiometry, dental exam, physical activity assessment, neurocognitive tests, and blood tests. So a lot of information that is going to be, it's going to make this data set extremely valuable. And there's room here in the front for some of you who just came in their seat to be able to, that we hope that we will benefit tremendously from it, from the data. And then we had a number of blood tests that were taken as well, and you have a list of all of them there. A lot of from hepatitis to DNA to extra plasma to A1C, and the list goes on and on. So a lot of exam and data that were collected. What are the disease endpoints in terms of annual follow-up? Well, you have them listed here. Annual follow-up by telephone, and in terms of examining any changes in lifestyle and health status, hospitalization and visit to the emergency room. We want to investigate other hospital events, so there's hospitalization and visit to the ER that are constantly being monitored and follow up. Mortality by cause, we need to review once we obtain copy of the death certificate and hospital record, those are being reviewed. The addition of fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular and pulmonary event, and then collecting information on new diagnosis, such as diabetes, hypertension, pulmonary, etc. Since then, there has been many, I don't know how many, maybe Dr. Laviglio knows about heart, but a lot of ancillary study. That means opportunity that the different field centers have had to come out with a proposal that would enhance what already is being collected in trying to answer any particular hypothesis. And so far, you have one that is called Calico. How they came with those names, Dr. Talavera may be able to give light. But this one is about genetic epidemiology of cost variant across the life course. Guardian, another genetic study, genetic and epidemiologic predictors of glucose homeostasis measure in Hispanic. SOLNAS, study of Latino on nutrition and physical activity assessment. Sociocultural ancillary study, which basically is trying to validate the many instruments that we have been using to make sure that they were appropriate in terms of cultural measures. sueño, sleep ancillary study, because of the serious problem that we have already identified in terms of the sleep apnea. Sol Youth, they will be starting actually any minute now. It started July 1st, I believe, and is collecting data on the children and youth of those parents that participated in the study. So that will be another way of finding more about the health of our children and be able, again, to monitor through a number of years. And then ECHOSOL, which is the echocardiographic hypertensive heart disease and Hispanic subgroup. And I'm sure there's others, but believe me, the list of people submitting ancillary studies is very high, and we're very happy that there is that much interest. Well, in terms of various lessons, first of all, we really had to engage in intensive community outreach and public relations, advertising, necessary to gain exposure. And that really involved developing a whole series of recruiting bilingual, bicultural staff, individuals that the community can trust, educating the community about health research and the importance of research and data to increase our understanding about Latino health. We needed also to engage in campaign to explain the diverse clinical examination, and we had to have our clinics opened or medical sites open on weekends to be able to accommodate Latino working schedule and family responsibility. We were not successful in the beginning in getting them to participate Monday through Friday, so we have to have a serious flexible schedule and weekends hour, because that, at least in Chicago and in some site, was the best time to be able to get the participant to come in and get their clinical examination. Integration of Latino culture in every interaction helped to connect with the individuals and families. So I wish we had more time to elaborate about that. Maybe in question and answer, we could talk about that. The establishment of community advisory committee. This was crucial because we really try to follow community-based participatory research approaches to the degree possible. And one of the ways that we were able to do that through the different sites is establishing a local community advisory board. They really met with us and really provided advice about how can we be able to reach out to the Latino community, what should be the marketing strategy. They review a lot of the materials and instruments in Spanish to make sure that we were really taking consideration the literacy level and that the Spanish was a simplistic one that were universal. And so there were so many different ways in which the advisory board at the different sites were instrumental in the success of the recruitment process. And they came up with many innovative ideas that help us, including the design of the poster. You know, many of those designs, it was done by some of the staff, but the community advisory board helped us to clean it up and to make it nice. And Brenda Lee, who's here from Miami, she really also provided a tremendous amount of leadership in all those, as one of her expertise happened to be marketing. And then, obviously, we developed a number of communication tools, including the SOL as a logo, that now people are identifying that with the SOL study. And our staff that goes to the field have that in their T-shirt, in the mailing form. Everywhere, poster, you see the SOL sign as a way of identifying the study. And that has really helped us a lot because people do remember the logo very easily. Most of the recent mailing, originally we had all this mailing of stuff about the soul. Now we just mail them a letter and a brochure, and that seems to be simple and nice enough to get to them or to take in doing home visit. We develop a series of other strategies like thank you card, birthday card. We don't know what else to do to make sure that people will remember, particularly when they are supposed to be followed. The no-show card also was developed to remind participants that there's still an opportunity to participate if they miss a visit or the first appointment. And then here we're highlighting Dr. Talavera, who has been extremely successful in getting the local media in San Diego to really talk day and night about soul. And so here you have him as a celebrity in different bilingual newspaper, El Informador, El Mexicano, El Sol de Tijuana, you name it. But most of the sites have similar Miami, Chicago, and the other really were successful in getting the media to really participate and help us get the word out. And I think that's about it. So now you're going to have Dr. Talavera talking about some preliminary results. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Greg Talavera, and I'm professor at the Graduate School of Public Health at San Diego State University, and I work do most of my research work out of what we call the Institute for Behavioral and Community Health Studies, IBOC. And I'm going to present some preliminary results. They are preliminary for a couple of reasons. First of all, we just completed measurement or recruitment of all the cohort, the 16,000, in June, and it takes quite a bit of time, as you can see from all the variables, to clean the data, weight the data, adjust it to the 2010 census, and to do all of those things. So the results that I have, I'm going to show you right now, are not for publication, not to be cited, but just to give us a little flavor of what Seoul will be producing in terms of manuscripts and formal presentations as we go forward in time. So as I mentioned, this represents two-thirds of the sample, or 11,316 participants who completed this rigorous 7.5-hour baseline examination with all those variables. Data collection was done in real time and web-based, so as participants were in our examination rooms across the country, the data was going via the internet directly to the coordinating center in North Carolina, and they were responsible for maintaining that huge data set. The other thing that you should understand is that the information that we'll be collecting on the Latinos that participated in the study is not going to be representative of the entire U.S. Latino population, but rather the communities from which we drew the sample from. But they will be representative of those communities because we did use a very rigorous technique, I think as Ida alluded to, called probability sampling. So we knew with probability what chance each person had of getting into the study if they were willing to participate. So I think she spelled out that the majority were female, and this again, anecdotally and through surveys, is due to the fact that the majority of the men that we encountered in our recruitment were working and found it difficult and economically difficult to participate in the study. But with the addition of Saturday and Sunday clinics, we did get a fairly good representative sample of males. And the reason why we have most of the individuals in the older age group, above 45, is because of our primary goals and our primary hypotheses being cardiovascular endpoints. We needed older Latinos, and so that we could count the number of cardiovascular events, heart attack, strokes, and death. So you can see the percentage of background, and based on the 2010 census, this is a representative sample of the distribution in the United States right now. We are majority Mexican American, and we have in our sample pretty closely mirrored the U.S. sample in the United States. The other nice thing about our study, and unlike some of the other studies that I've participated in and read in, is that we have a good distribution of SES. We have rich and poor, we have highly educated and not so educated, and although we had anticipated getting a better language distribution, it still seems that there's a strong retention for the Spanish language amongst even our second generation Latinos in the cities that we were at. But this is really nice. Getting most of my prior work, we've only been able to, you know, recruit one SES group or another, so we'll be able to look at that stratum. So in terms of the results that I'm about to present, it's very important that you understand how we got those. Our For instance, our myocardial infarction was not determined by hospital records or an EKG. It was determined largely by self-report. So that is one of the limitations at this point in time. As we go forward with our cohort into the future, this information will become more accurate as we collect records from the hospital and the emergency rooms, and hopefully with our renewal that we'll be able to see them back and clarify some of these things. But this is how we defined them, and the reason we use these definitions is it's comparable to other national studies that exist in the United States, such as NHANES and MESA and so forth. So it allows, that's another important difference with the Hispanic study, is that we don't have non-Latinos in the study, so we have to draw on national samples from the general population to do our comparisons. So to get started then, this is our first look at the prevalence of coronary heart disease by gender. And as expected, we would see that males have a greater prevalence of coronary heart disease than females. Again, this weight, these samples are not weighted and age adjusted just quite yet, but it gives us a kind of a sneak peek at what we're going to be finding. This is breaking down the coronary heart disease by age group, and as we would expect, particularly for males, a strong trend towards increasing age and increasing prevalence of coronary heart disease. We see the same pattern in females with a slight exception here. The other thing you may be asking is, how did we define Hispanic Latino? And basically, when we approach individuals at their doorstep or over the telephone, we ask them, are you of Hispanic Latino background? In some areas, like Miami, they had trouble with that question. So if they had a puzzled look, the recruiters were prompted to say, we define Hispanic Latinos as people coming from these countries. And then some of the background groups got it. But in some cases, there is, as you know, it's not always useful to identify yourself as Hispanic Latino in the United States because of discrimination. So even though some households were speaking Spanish in the background, and they would simply deny that they were of that background, and unfortunately they were excluded from possible recruitment into the study. But I don't think that was a majority of the cases. And then we decided to go with background group because ethnicity is a self-identified marker for people of different backgrounds and diversity within a Hispanic background. So we use the term background throughout our publications. And we did take into account the fact that some individuals, as you know, the U.S. population in general and the Hispanic population as well is becoming a mixture of individuals from different backgrounds, including countries of origin and so forth, and mixtures between Latino and non-Latino families. So we're trying to keep a tab on that as well by asking, the birthplace of your parents and grandparents. So we sometimes use that as a way to describe our population. So moving on to our attempts to take some preliminary looks at the SOL results with other national studies, we see here in this slide that we're trying to compare our coronary heart disease results, which I just showed you, and compare them with NHANES. One slide ahead. This is our first comparison between background groups. So for males, you can see that there is quite a bit of difference, say, between the SOL Dominican group and the SOL Puerto Rican group in this case. But that pattern doesn't hold up for female. So some variations between background groups and gender. Again, these have not been fully weighted, and so we haven't run any statistical analysis to see if these are statistically significant differences. But we do see some interesting trends that we hope to explore when the data is finally complete. This is the stroke prevalence by gender. And here we see that, again, males have a greater prevalence of stroke compared to females within the SOL cohort. Not surprising. That's pretty well characterized in the literature. And then when we look at age groups, with some mild exceptions, we do see increasing prevalence with increasing age for both males and females, although the gradient's a little bit different for each group. Let's see, am I going in the right direction? there we go. So this is the same analysis by subgroup for stroke. And again, we see some interesting comparisons here where Dominicans have, male Dominicans have a prevalence that's quite a bit higher than the sole Mexican-American group or the sole Mexican group. Not so much seen in the females. So now the subsequent slides are trying to compare to the NHANES data. And they did use, we tried to use our definition, which is similar to their definitions. And but because NHANES has predominantly Mexican Americans, we chose to only compare those background groups. But in this sample, in this analysis, both of our samples were standardized to the 2000 census because the 2010 wasn't out when we conducted this analysis. So this shows some interesting findings here. Again, these colors here represent the NHANES, all ethnicities, Hispanic whites, and Mexican Americans, and then our sole, all backgrounds, and Mexican Americans. So if you look at the overall NHANES prevalence of myocardial infarction, and again, this is just cross-sectional data, it's quite a bit higher than the sole all backgrounds prevalence of there. So we're not sure what exactly is going on. Some of us are going to be talking to them. Pardon?
Is that the same age group?
Yeah.
45 to 74-year-olds?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah, this is for the same age groups. They also go from 18 to 74, too. Yeah. So, yeah, so we're not sure if the Mexican-Americans that were recruited for NHANES are significantly different than what we captured in Seoul, or there is something about our methodology, but we need to explore those kind of variances a little bit more in the future. We're going to take questions at the end. So hold on to your questions there. So again, looking at females, and we look at the NHANES trends here, not terribly different yet, but again, we don't have any statistical analyses run on here with any confidence yet, but we do see a little bit of difference in the patterns there. Moving on to stroke, the variance is not as great as in what we saw for coronary heart disease, but we do see, again, that for the NHANES stroke, self-reported stroke among all of these categories over here, the prevalence seems to be higher, at least for all the groups and definitely for the Mexican-American groups. So just focusing in on NHANES Mexican-Americans and SOL Mexican-Americans, we see a little bit of difference, but later on we'll be able to tell if that's statistically significant. So that kind of just gives you a flavor of the type of analysis that we'll be doing in the future. We have tons and tons of data, as was mentioned previously, and Dr. Castaneda will be telling you about how you might be able to get involved in analyzing this. There should be thousands of publications that are available here looking at coronary heart disease and depression, coronary heart disease and acculturation, a lot of different options there. But basically, most of our findings were consistent with the previous literature. The sample demonstrated lower rates of myocardial infarction and stroke compared to non-Hispanic whites in the NHANES data. There were some variances, and to me this is going to be one of the more interesting things, is looking at our background group variations and trying to figure out what are the predictors for those differences across the Hispanic background or subgroups. And then, you know, our future research, which is what we're kind of doing with some of our ancillary studies, is to look at the psychosocial and behavioral factors as they relate to some of these hard cardiovascular endpoints. There are very few studies in the United States, both on a small scale or on a large scale, that have the ability to look at the complex, in-depth psychosocial cultural factors, the biological factors, and the genetic factors. We, as was mentioned, we are banking DNA and RNA on all these individuals, and when future analysis are done on those, you'll have a pretty good complete picture to explore what are the relationships between those variables and what the relative importance of those variables are in explaining the Hispanic paradox, or if it exists, and just proving whether or not it does exist. So with that, I'd like to stop. We will be taking questions after our next presenter, which is Dr. Castaneda, also from IBOC in San Diego. This? Next slide.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sheila Castaneda. I am a co-investigator on SOL for the San Diego site. I'm involved with community relations and retention. So Aida, Dr. Giacello, is our community relations chair nationally. And so we're creating a public service announcement right now to help retain our participants. I think we're seeking 95% retention, so it's a high goal. And we're maintaining that goal, so I think we're really proud of ourselves. We didn't, Dr. Talbert didn't mention that we were the first study to make our recruitment goal early. So it's the first study to use probabilistic sampling and actually make that recruitment goal early. So with that, we're going to be going forward, and it's just really exciting, and it's exciting to see all of you here, hopefully increasing enthusiasm to get involved. And so we're going to talk about how to get involved. And the main way to get involved right now is going to be through manuscripts. So right now the data is local through the four field centers and also through the coordinating center until I think it's March 2013. So that's when the data is going to go public. So right now you can work with us to lead manuscripts, get involved with different manuscripts, even possibly write additional ancillary studies to analyze the data. But the main question is why become involved? So for us, this is the largest epidemiological study of Hispanic Latino background groups ever, I think internationally. So this, we have sufficient subgroup sample sizes to actually look at comparisons across the groups. And from the other preliminary analyses that we've been running, and some of it we didn't really present today, but you see prevalence rates really differ for asthma, smoking, obesity, diabetes across the groups, and some groups are more at risk than others. And so for policy, for all of our health programming, for targeting, tailoring at the community level, you know, these data, and we'll get to policy implications, but it's going to be really important to be able to compare the groups. The other thing is the other national studies, so from the CDC, we have NHANES, we have the National Health Interview Survey. These studies have only looked at Mexican-American backgrounds, so they've largely excluded the other groups. So we're actually including Dominican, Puerto Rican, Cuban, and then Central South American. So that's, you know, for policy and even for your grant writing in the future, this is going to be something to cite. So how do you get involved? So again, I mentioned in 2013 the data is going to go public. So until then, we have a process, and it's called to become an affiliated investigator. We have a couple affiliated investigators in the audience right now. So what we're requiring you to do is to go to the public website and then contact one of our PIs. And through the PI, you develop a relationship and you can become an affiliated investigator. And the affiliated investigator has certain rights. I'll just show you. So on the website, there's a drop-down menu for affiliated investigators. And so through that link, you're able to submit a publication, well, a proposal for a publication, a proposal for an abstract. That's kind of how you get involved with the study if you're not kind of a paid co-investigator on the study. So we have a process for that. And then the public website, so the tabs that are in kind of an orange color, this is all available to the public. So within that, you can see all of our measures for the baseline exam. There's the methods, the background, the published papers that are available thus far, directory. So every single PI or every single staff member across all of our sites are listed in our directory. But then kind of OSMB and study members area, that's more reserved for our local study investigators. So again, so before the data is available, contact one of us, and that's why we're really here today. That's our whole purpose, is to get you involved and to increase the new generation of researchers focusing on Hispanic Latino. So please come and talk to us afterwards if you want to be involved. And then after, so in 2013, when the data goes public, you're going to go through this link at the NHLBI website. So a lot of the other NHLBI-funded studies are going to be on this website. Okay, that's our main website. And again, this is just an example. So public use file about the study. You can go down, there's information on the overview, all the different ancillary studies. And so the whole publication process for the main study is also for the ancillary studies. And some of the ancillary studies have their data complete now, which is really exciting. So the whole publication process is the same. But here, you know, the public manuals, that's the baseline measures, publications to date, videos. So we have that information. And then once you become an affiliate investigator, and we can pass this around, there's an actual guidebook that the Coordinating Center has developed of kind of instructions on how to submit a manuscript. So we can pass this around. But, and again, as an affiliated investigator, you have limited website access, you have reference materials, and also the ability to submit a manuscript proposal. And that's it for my publication, or my presentation.
I just realized that we made one mistake. The data is protected for 2 years after it's complete for the parent study and 1 year for ancillary study. So this data will not be public for 2 years after, next month probably.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be the end of fall 2013 probably.
Yeah. So we're going to open it up to questions now, I guess. And you want to moderate?
Well, thank you for that great presentation. Are there any questions from the audience?
Hi, I just wanted to clarify. Actually, Ed Haynes previously did have information on other subgroups, not just Mexican-Americans, Hispanic Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. So you could, if you wanted to, make comparisons with the previous data for Cubans and Puerto Ricans. But you can, with the National Health Interview Survey, also look at other Latino subgroups. They have sufficient numbers, and they have published. One of the ways of doing that is combining several years of data to get, like, three-year averages. And so there have been publications on other Latino subgroups. So if you want to expand your horizons as to what you're considering for comparison.
You can actually do that, but the problem is with the weighting.
Yeah.
So it becomes complicated when you combine the years. The weight, there's not a way that can allow you to weight across the years. You can only do it within years. At least that's when I think the data is problematic.
Right, but the National Center for Health Statistics has a data users conference, and so that may be something some of you who are interested in exploring those other data sets for comparison, you may want to go to the free conference in Washington, D.C.
Okay, up here in the front.
I guess I can answer that one. I guess if they can recruit 4,000 on their own, they can join. But I just don't know how that can happen. It was a difficult choice for the project office to make selections. They were, they had, I think, 26 applications, and they only had enough funds for four, and they were looking for, stable samples and experienced investigators and had that community-based. There were a lot of factors that went into their decision of, Texas versus California and others. I know it's difficult, but I don't think at this time that anybody can really catch up, to be honest with you. But I don't know how the renewal is going to look, to be honest. So.
I just echo what Greg is saying. For the renewal to qualify to compete with those that are currently funded, you need to demonstrate that you have 4,000 Latino sample in your locality to be able to go to the next phase.
Yeah.
Well, at least that's my understanding. I don't know, I may be wrong.
Hi. Hello, I have a question or a few questions. First of all,
Yes, we have smoking history on them too. Right.
The other question is in terms of, maybe I missed it because I was 5 minutes late, but for those 7 hours and a half that they participated in the study, were they compensated in any way?
Yes. We were allowed to compensate them for their time and travel, and it was approximately $80.
Wonderful. And my last question is, in regards to the follow-up, what are the barriers that you're encountering in terms of following up through mail and telephone? Because we know that there's a high mobility among our Latino population, at least in the District of Columbia, and we're about 500,000 Salvadoreños, by the way, that we love to be included.
yeah.
And they were included
in Miami.
In Miami.
Whereas we thought we were going to get Cubans in Little Havana. We found Salvadoreños, Nicaraguenses, and they are living in Costa Rica. That's why on the second round we had to move to Hialeah to get the Cubans, because the Central American were heavily waiting in our
system. Wonderful. And just to add on that, according to the 2010 census, we're now 25% Central American.
In this state?
Yes.
In this
No, the nation. It has, according to the 2010 census, we have moved up to 25%, so we are now higher than Cubans. Salvadoreños.
Oh, I see what you're
saying. All Central Americans.
Amongst,
oh, okay.
Amongst Latinos.
Yes. But going back to the issue of the follow-up and mailing and phone, encounter a lot of issues with that. I wonder if you want to
come to... We'll answer this in conjunction. I think that was one of the decisions that factored into NHLBI deciding which sites to choose. Because when they interviewed us, they explicitly probed for stability of your population. And I think that was a very important factor. There are many population groups, like migrant farm workers and so forth, that this kind of model of follow-up would just have been probably not possible, and so I think that factored into their decision. How stable is this Latino population in this community, and how well can you prove that you can track them? So some of that was demonstrated history of working with the population too. So, but for details on how we're retaining, I'm going to turn it over.
First of all, the recruitment was very challenging as well, for the same reason. You know, on one hand, Latino is very mobile. You just mentioned that. They exchange phone constantly. We know about that, that if the phone bill comes $500, they're disconnected. Then the daughter's name goes into the next phone that the family gets, and then they keep, you know, moving around. More recently, they're using prepaid, you know, kind of plan. And so when they run out of money, you cannot reach them for a while. And so the list goes on and on. Then in particularly in Chicago, problem about people's distrustfulness. They just felt it sounded like too good for them. The fact that we were offering more than $5,000 in examination and giving them afterward the results, they said, are you sure you're not going to charge me again? Are you sure you're not going to come back? I don't have any money. So there was distrustfulness that we need through the community campaign to try to overcome. The whole gentrification, which made it difficult, they were constantly being pushed out of their neighborhood. And now with the retention, it's similar kinds of challenges. Those that work in landscaping go out, you know, the area, at least in the case of Chicago, for the cold weather. And so there's a period of time that we just don't know where they are, and no one knows where they are. The same thing of moving often. One of the challenges that we have even with the retention is that you have multi-family living in one small apartment. And so when we go back, those families have moved into different areas. Quite, you know, we have to do a whole investigation to find now what exactly is happening. The problem about retention and follow-up is not only just being able to reach out to the individual that participated, but even to get the medical records. We find the medical record has different last names in the medical record, so we cannot be able to match them, you know, appropriately, although last name is spelled. So a lot of problem in trying to get the medical record as well when we're trying to document the event. Or people using different names, they're hospitalized because they don't have health insurance and they don't want to, you know, their legal status or whatever else. So there are
number of challenges that we are overcoming them as we move forward. But despite that, we were able, all the sites were able to complete the 4,000, and actually we were able to do more than that, close to 4,100 or 4,200 and some sites. So we were able to do a lot more than what was expected, despite the fact that it was a tension constantly because of all the challenges that we were experiencing. And now the challenge is how can we be able to make sure that we don't lose them in the process. Do you want to add something, Sheila?
Yeah, so for retention, so Aida is heading our...
Louder.
So I'm really involved with retention locally in San Diego, and if you think about the numbers, it's around probably 0.00% 1% that we can't find, that are the hard to reach, as we call them. So now we have, I think, 3 backup phone numbers, proxy contacts to follow up through our AS annual
email,
phone.
Email, Facebook.
Join us on Facebook. We're doing email blasts. We have our national PSA campaign. We're in the local media. So those that are hard to reach, it's really not a problem. Even though people are moving, even moving to Mexico in our area, we're still reaching them, getting medical records and everything. So.
And we hope that with the media campaign that Dr. Emma Huerta is a spokesperson, and he basically starts saying, gracias a su participación, el estudio continúa. Thanks to your participation, the study continues. And then he goes on saying how for them to continue involved, they need to give us information ongoing in terms of their updated contact.
We had a question in the back.
Yeah, I actually have 2 questions. So the first is around becoming an affiliated member. So we do it through a site, but would that allow, so if you become an affiliated member with the San Diego site, we still have access to the 3 other sites, their data, so we can, before
yes.
It's publicly available.
At this point in time, all ancillary studies and all manuscripts are mandated, so to speak, I don't know what the proper word, to use all the sample that we have.
Okay.
So they have not approved any manuscript just looking at a single site. They have not approved a manuscript looking at a single background group, and the same thing goes for ancillary studies. They really want to maintain the full, robust nature of the opportunity.
Then my second question was around the sleep study and the oral exam. So it was a 7-hour survey. How did you do the sleep study? Did they do it at home?
Good question. Yeah, they were, both physical activity and sleep monitors were devices that they wore and they went home with them. The sleep monitor was put on top of their head and measured O2 and airflow and things like that, some very basic measures, but was considered diagnostic for sleep apnea, and we diagnosed a fair amount of cases on that. But the ancillary study, the Sol Sueño study, is doing a home-based sleep study, so it's going to have greater detail.
Okay, we had a question over here.
I don't have there's a 2.5-hour battery of questions, and I don't have them all memorized, to be honest with you, but they're posted on our web, and they're often modeled after other national studies like NHANES and MESA and so forth, so that they would be more comparable. Sheila could probably pull it up for us real quick.
Yeah.
She knows where every variable is in the data set.
And also to remind that we had our committee, a translation committee, that we looked at all the instruments. We worked at each site with conducting focus groups to assess the usability and the acceptability and how the translations were resonating. Especially, we identified several questionable items throughout the battery of questionnaires, and especially with social mobility questions and concepts. So we were not looking at the mere translation of a medical term, but also the concept behind it of some, especially with the social demographic and economic measures.
Yeah.
And we did that. We processed that through a committee, which also in turn linked with a contractor.
for the official translation.
Yeah, a lot of the sites that had contributed staff to that were native speakers from diverse backgrounds, and so that captured that part. And then we interview administered. So if someone had a puzzled look on their face or they didn't, you know, they could refine the question, they could explain it better. So we feel like it's pretty good data. But we understand your point. In fact, in some cases where it was a validated instrument and we didn't like the wording, we overrid it just, you know, at the risk of decreasing the validity of the questionnaire so it would be better understood.
We heard in the blue.
My name is Jeannie Olson. I work at NHLBI in the epidemiology branch, which is the group that's providing the sponsorship and oversight for SOL, as well as a number of our other longitudinal cohort studies. And I just feel compelled to say a little bit more about this public use data stuff. As our presenters said, the SOL data are expected to be available on the BioLink website in late 2013. It's not exactly public use in that people still need to apply to receive the data. They have to have a study question rationale. They have to have IRB, evidence of IRB review. So it's not freely available. There is still a process. Because the data are more widely available, some pains have been taken to remove particularly sensitive information, or pains will have been taken, I should say, to remove particularly sensitive information, information that could be an identifier, that is, you know, maybe you live in San Diego and you're 90 years old and you weigh 400 pounds, people might be able to figure out who you are, even though your name, your address, and everything else. So that's a limitation of the data there. Also, there are no biospecimens available through that public website. So for people who are interested in more granularity of the data, number one, access to biospecimens if they want to do ancillary studies, and third, I think most importantly, taking advantage of the expertise of the investigators who collected the data and understand the study well. Even when data become available on BioLink, you still have the opportunity to collaborate within the study and in fact encourage them to study.
Thank you, Jeannie, for so much to know on the study. Appreciate the words there. But even then, too, there's one more layer, too. You still have to go through our publications and presentations committee for them to approve the manuscript proposal, because we don't want to have overlapping data and we don't want to have, timing of publications that one manuscript may trump another one before it's gotten to press. So they kind of coordinate all that. So, but I think that's a good point, that working with the group right now gets you access to a cadre of experts across the four sites and the reading centers that can provide you with that expertise. And that's particularly true for our very complex data related to physical activity monitoring and how to interpret that, the sleep data, et cetera, EKG data. It's really valuable to have that kind of expertise on your manuscript or available for you in your planning.
And also, once you have your manuscript approved, you'll only have access to the data for that manuscript, because they're really discouraging data mining. Software, so that's, we're starting to do that locally. So if you wanted to work, for example, with the San Diego site, there's another investigator in the audience. We meet every Friday, and we're analyzing the data net right now, and it's really exciting. But there's a whole process she's explaining.
Any more questions? Okay, up in the front.
Okay, so that clarifies the fact that you have to put in separate requests. Like if you want to do a paper and you're granted the use of the data and you have another hypothesis that you want to test, then you would have to put a second request.
Correct.
Okay.
So when you propose your manuscript concept, you create the variable tables that you anticipate using for your analysis. If you say, oh, I forgot about that variable, yeah, you have to come back in with another request. And again, it's to keep everybody separate and not duplicating publications and so forth.
My second question is whether that data has zip code data?
I think that's one of the... I'm not sure if that's made available public. We have that information, obviously, but I'm not sure it's... I don't think it's available.
You can't do multi-level analysis with this data.
Say that again?
Then you can't do multi-level analysis with this data.
That would be an ancillary study.
Okay.
Right, but there has been paper proposed to look at social determinants of health, housing, and other neighborhood characteristics. So I think there must be a way of identifying to do those kinds of analysis.
Well, it's going to be, there is an ancillary study that's under review right now at NIH to actually do environmental assessment that would look at parks and physical activity, you know, environment and food, you know, stores and things, you know, the state-of-the-art stuff that would be layered on top of what we have now. I think what we have right now is pretty limited, and I'm not sure if it's even public, the zip code data, but, yeah, so I think it would be difficult to do that right now.
And keep in mind that there's already over 100 manuscripts that have been proposed. So every week, people are submitting manuscripts, you know, to the publication committee. So we just strongly encourage each one of you who are interested to immediately identify one of the sites that you want to work with and put together your ideas. At least what we do at the individual site is that we ask the individual to develop an abstract about what is it they're thinking about, and then develop that into a full proposal. And we're talking about, what is it, 6 or 7 pages? And you work with the local PI to make sure, because this is hypothesis-driven, we want to make sure that it's the best possible abstract and proposal, manuscript proposal that has been developed in terms of quality. And once we feel that the quality is there, then we encourage you to submit it online.
Okay, we had a question in the back.
What about, did you guys collect any data on documentation status? And would that be made available to
No.
That was not asked. It's prohibited by the IRB. And the same thing with Social Security. If people volunteer the information, we write it down, but it's not mandatory.
What they did at CHIS was they asked about, you know, whether or not you were born in the U.S. and then if you had a visa or permanent residency. So we've actually published a number of papers based on those questions backing our way into it. So I don't know if there's a way in these data to be able to back your way into documentation status.
We purposely did.
I'm not familiar with those studies, but our goal of creating and retaining a cohort outweighed that desire to get documentation status. The discussions were more in favor of, you know, we're just worried about health here. That's an area we can't answer all questions about the social and psycho circumstances of Latinos in the United States. So we chose that approach.
Other.
Yes, I was wondering if a group of people wanted to put in a proposal, is there any limit on the number of authors?
Now with the primary papers already established, or the prevalence papers, the lead author submitting a manuscript idea to the publications committee is allowed to choose 3 other persons on their manuscript.
One plus three
for a total of 4, and then it's opened up to the other reading centers and PI sites. And if there are no takers, then the remaining up to 12. I'm sorry. Yeah, the limit is 12. So if there are no takers, then the remaining slots are available to the lead author to select individuals from your own or other personal network.
And you can have 3 primary authored papers
at
in
one
the
time.
Queue at one time.
Yeah. Until they're published. And then one falls off and you can do another one.
And you're expected to work with your writing group on the paper. And then you can also, once you have the paper approved, well, you can also, the process to present the data at a conference, so you would submit the abstract and go through the same process.
My understanding is that you have already started the follow-up data collection process.
follow-up takes place over the phone. It's just over the phone follow-up at this point in time. And basically, they have a set of questions targeting cardiovascular disease that they ask them on the phone. If they say they had chest pain and they went to the doctor, or the ER, or the doctor, we go after those medical records, and we adjudicate those findings that way. That's our annual follow-up right now. On average, it'll be about three and a half years with the current funding cycle. As mentioned, we have been informed, although not seen, an RFP for a renewal of this project, and we don't know what it would look like. It may involve bringing them all back for another physical exam or a continuation of the phone follow-up.
And the phone follow-up data we have is for close to 100% at this point of your baseline participants, or is it
it's only
different
That I don't have off the top of my head, but if we call someone up and they say that they are doing fine, nothing's changed, we actually don't get any additional medical record information. We just take that information over. If they say they went to the hospital or the emergency room or had an asthma attack, those are the endpoints that we're most interested in to get, and we do go after the medical records and adjudicate those. So I don't remember what percentage have had an MI, a heart attack, or an asthma condition. But if you want to email, I can tell you.
And the purple?
I had a question. You had mentioned that there were already 100 submissions for potential manuscripts. And so if you had a rough estimate of how long it takes for a request to be processed, and also once you do have access data, how long
the time frame
do you have to get that manuscript out?
Well, right now what we're doing is asking people to submit the proposal. And immediately the publication committee is meeting twice a month, and they're very quickly. You know, if you submit it within 2 weeks, no more than 3 weeks, you already know whether your manuscript has been accepted. In terms of the developing of the actual manuscript, that what we are telling everybody, there are a couple of things. We're still having some challenges in terms of the acculturation scales that we are constructing for the study. So those papers that are looking at acculturation, we are advising to, you know, to slightly change that focus for the time being until the committee come up with a conclusion about how we're going to go about it in doing some of the challenges that have emerged in terms of the scale. In terms of the, and then for the actual paper, we want to have the 16,000 total sample. If you are looking nationwide, I mean nationwide meaning all the sites, which right now is not available. Any minute, maybe in the next month or so, we will get the 16,000 to begin the analysis. But right now, is not available, and that's why here we presented only 11,000 or so of the cases. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess for like data sets like NLOX, which you put in the request for, parts of the public, if you were granted access to follow through with the manuscript, you were given like a 6-month period to get that manuscript out.
No, I think we're giving a year. I think you have a year to do that. But one more point is that I also want to mention that one of the roles of the publication and presentation committee is to give you some good feedback. So if you come in with an idea that might be slightly, let's just say, off or too wide, they may give you some constructive feedback on how to narrow it or make it better, because of their intimate understanding of the database and the sample.
In the back?
I just had a question about, I'm unclear about the longitudinal follow-up. So am I correct that this will be once a year contact by phone without physical measures? Is that
correct? At this point in time, yes.
So there will be no further direct contact with any of the participants in person. And so
it varies by site. In Chicago, we're heavily doing it face-to-face because of some of the challenges with the phone. So
it'll
varies
be once
by
a year, though.
But it's still once a year.
There's no interim telephone contact.
Well, we contact them once. We have newsletters, we have birthday cards. I mean, we have.
But if you're doing utilization recall, you would, you know, for the last 30 days or, you know, 90 days, you'd have that annually, but you wouldn't know anything.
Up here in the front.
Do you post on your website the manuscripts that have been approved already? You have like 100 in the queue. I mean, I need to spend time on 7 pages.
Well, that's the role of your sponsoring PI, is
to work with you.
Yeah, to let you know what's been covered already.
I wonder what's in the data in terms of stress, either you know, daily hassles or chronic, in terms of self-report or maybe cortisol? Anything?
So we have cortisol data. We have some of the inflammatory markers, CRP. We also have the only self-report stress is perceived discrimination. So that's kind of a proxy for
And the Spielberg anxiety and the Spielberg depression questionnaire.
SF-12. Right, the quality of life,
SF-12,
they can't
come
mental health.
So we have time for one more question. Okay.
It's not really a question. It's more, how can we get access to the slides? Are they going to be on the website?
No, those are not for publication. The website itself has a lot of information, though, that besides the results, the preliminary.
Yeah, I don't need the results, just sort of the background.
The background, we have
couple. We have brochures and fact sheets.
If you go to the website, it's quite rich. We have two publications already. The methodology and the sampling strategy have already been published,
yeah.
And so it gives you a lot of information there. All the instruments are there, with the exception of the SF-12, which is copyrighted. And there's guidebooks on how to access the data. There's also a derived variable dictionary, which is very important if you're going to be looking at variables that need to be derived. What else, Kristen?
That was one I couldn't find.
It's not on there?
I couldn't get it.
Well, it's not. It's
all right, then I would have to give that one to you.
Oh, I got that one.
Well, thank you for attending our panel presentation, and I'd like to also thank the panel for a wonderful presentation.